Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pools in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lease. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Out.
many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No. Nope.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This, God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, no, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him, and then you felt like you wasn't worthy, and so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room, and I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me, and I said, I want you to do this graph for me, and that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on doubted drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way because your package is going to keep going right on by because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it's on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Friends, it is time once again for our daily message of hope. And with today's message, here is Richard Eaton.
Friends, to brighten your day, here is our message of hope. Afraid of change? You can't do anything about it. Change is inevitable. Growth is the great fundamental principle, the function of our lives. The seed in the ground will rot if it does not sprout and grow. And so will our minds and souls and bodies. Without conscious action and striving, our Creator answers most prayers in the terms of ideas for action. He doesn't give us something for nothing. He expects us to use what He gives us in active exercise of a freedom which He permits our minds and souls to exercise in reactions to the life patterns of ups and downs, strange events, curious, unforeseen happenings. Human consistencies, all can be changed according to the way our mind evolves, adapts, and grows. Nothing in this world is so inevitable, nor hardly so obvious. The fact is, everything does change. So often we'd like things to remain the same. It'd be so comfortable, nice. We get used to things. We adapt ourselves to a certain pattern, and then suddenly, without any warning, it changes. What are you going to do about it? Well, the first step in gaining a happier and more satisfying state of mind is recognition of the significance of this fact. Everything changes. Everything in life is changing as you and I are changing. And we must do more than this to take proper advantage of the ceaseless change inevitable in our lives. We must consciously react to direct actions that change in the paths of improvement, in the growth of our mind and soul. Change alone is inevitable and constant. But change alone is not growth. It is not progress. We have to do the progress ourselves. We have to convert. We have to adapt. Growth is a cornerstone, the primary marvel of our earthly lives. Our Creator has provided for physical growth in a pattern in which He has given us only limited powers to alter. From babyhood, we go to childhood. From childhood to adolescence. From adolescence to adulthood. And so the story grows. Physical growth. But the way we adapt ourselves to prepare ourselves for those unusual situations, the ones which we can call pleasant or unpleasant, that depends on the way we grow in our minds, the way we grow in the power of adaptation. For friends, life is a constant adaptation. Every phase of life presents a spectacle of change. And as a consequence, the spectacle of retrogression, a standstill status or progress of growth. In each case of progress or growth, there is a constant overcoming, a vanquishment of the obstacles met in the Creator's pattern of constant change. See, that's all important. All about us, we see growth or deterioration taking place in grass, in flowers, in vegetables, in pets, in our children, in our own body. But the thing that's important is the way we adapt ourselves to this change. That's all important. In our affairs, all too often, we select for cultivation the very things we don't want. Courses that lead to mistakes and trouble, sorrow and pain. Then we carefully endow these selections with the full energy of our thoughts and words. We water them with tears and self-pity. Give them the concentration of undivided attention. And then we have a way of wondering why, indeed of all our efforts, we grow in a crop of trouble and discord. Let me tell you, it is not necessary. Let us deliberately refuse to turn our thoughts to those weeds we do not want. We must discipline our minds to concentrate on the good, on positive thoughts, the sunshine and water and soil that produce good in our lives, on the thought energy, the emotional powers we concentrate on our affairs to convert inevitable change into growth. In other words, our job every single day, and this day too, is to watch where we're going, what we're doing. If we want love and happiness, be sure it's to love and happiness that you devote your attention, not to discord and bitterness and resentment. If you want success in some field, give full recognition. Yes, give full recognition to success, and it's yours already. Think positive thoughts. Fix the life-giving force of your attentions and assurance and faith on the good you already have. Look for it in every circumstance. Now make no mistake about it. Change is inevitable. You can't halt the process of change any more than you can keep your child a baby. In the words of Dr. Arthur H. Compton, everywhere the conditions of life are changing rapidly, and these changes are all in the direction of greater interdependence. That is, making better cooperation of paramount importance. The point is, that in this process of change, we go forward or we go backward. We bow to circumstances or we rise above circumstances. Of course, we cannot be expected to see beyond the point of our understanding any more than we can see beyond the horizon limit of our eyes. But the point is, we can master the thoughts we permit to remain in our minds. We can choose our thoughts according to God's laws. We know we get out of life exactly what we put into it. Nothing more, nothing less. We know if we sow love, we shall reap love. We sow hate, we reap hate. We have the power to concentrate on whatever kind of thoughts we choose. We know that if we endeavor to have an understanding heart, we shall find elsewhere an understanding heart. We know if we pardon, we shall be pardoned. We know if we give, we shall receive. Look at your own picture, 5, 10, or 20 years ago. See what a change has been made on the outside, in the outside person. You will scarcely know yourself. Well, that's the growth of the body. But God has given you the mastery of your mind. Your soul can keep pace with the growth of the body, just as the less perceptible growth of the trunk of the tree matches the more visible enlargement of its limbs. Look back at what you were thinking 5, 10, or 20 years ago, at the obstacles which seemed insurmountable then, at the joys and sorrows of yesterday. And just as it's hard to believe, those old photographs are you. Yes, we really looked as we did, not as we see ourselves in the mirror today. So it is equally difficult to imagine the progress, the maturity, that our soul has accomplished and made in the course of these years. In other words, we do not change without more than we change within. This is all important to know. There is no limit to the transformation which can take place in your mind. When we dig a little deeper in our search for answers to life's questions, when we wisely read between the lines, we find that God puts his blessings upon our efforts and draws us close, imparts to us his divine wisdom. We find, first of all, that our soul, our mind, gains maturity as we react in a positive manner to the pattern of life, no matter how unpleasant or unexpected. A pattern which we may not be able to change, except in our minds. But remember, that's all important in our mind, because what actually counts is what we think, the way we feel about something. The growth of the soul, therefore, depends upon our free reaction to the problems with which we are faced. Our life is part of a divine plan, carefully prepared in every detail. Each moment of that plan offers a marvelous opportunity for our adaptation, for the growth of our soul and of our mind. The whole picture of our lives is so much brighter than the small pieces that hold and which our minds are prone to dwell on at length. Isolated from the background of all this, the whole, some parts, may look awfully black. But let me tell you, our Creator in time ultimately moves in on our subconscious mind and plays a pleasant trick on all of us. The unpleasant experiences of the past are relegated to the past. When we realize the power of our mind, the real secret escapes us as long as we fail to exercise that freedom of choice, all important, endowed to us by our Creator. This mystery of growth functions in time of crises more than ever before. We say, why does this happen to me? How could this happen to me? I don't deserve this. Suppose we say, this is an opportunity, a challenge to react and gain greater maturity. Life with its steady, compelling urge to grow means that any door may open to us at any moment. Life makes us beneficiary of the physical experiences that the ages have bequeathed to us, of the signs and inventions of genius, of the mental and physical work of our forefathers that set us free to seek the larger spiritual things of life. Friends, let us profit by these examples of the past, by physical knowledge, to prepare ourselves better for the experiences of life. Yes, we can encounter experiences of all kinds along life's highway, good and bad, pleasant and unpleasant. We can prepare ourselves for many trials simply through the richness of knowledge of those who lived before us. But along that same highway, each of us is certain to meet some experiences so different from those for which we are prepared and so unexpected. But the point is, are they going to catch us unprepared and unaware? Each of us on life's journey must face a great many such surprising and disconcerting experiences that happen every day, any minute, and take us unprepared, unaware. The knowledge that somehow or other we have inside of us the strength, the power, and mastery of our mind to control every situation, to react, and so to change in our mind our feelings about any problem and situation is all important. What a wonderful privilege is ours to be a human being, to know that we endow with the mastery of our mind, that we can control through our reactions whatever is our fate. No, we may not control circumstances or situations, but we can control our life because we control that which we feel about life. What a wonderful challenge it is. Friends, you've been listening once again to our message of hope. God bless you, everyone.
Listen again tomorrow for another Message of Hope with Richard Eaton. This is UBC, the United States.
because I used to observe that a lot of little shacks used to be by the track where black people were.
With the room in the back.
Yes, with the room in the back. That was a safety net.
Yeah.
Where black people who would move here and there and go from here and there looking for jobs, that's usually why we move, and the jobs would play out like they always did.
And do.
But we had a place to go when the sun went down. But now, those shacks by the track don't exist anymore. They came and built highways right alongside of those railroad tracks where those shacks used to be. Super highways. So now, if you get on a highway, you might notice that if you, sometimes you're right alongside of a railroad track. You see trains passing
that
as you're driving.
That is true.
Down a super highway.
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, those highways used not to be there in the northwestern hemisphere. It used to be shacks along there. A lot of those shacks were on what we call railroad property. But the railroad people, the people that ran the railroads, didn't care much because nobody wanted to be down. That wasn't prime real estate.
No.
Nobody wanted to be by the tracks anyway. So black people used to build those shacks around there back when black people knew how to build shacks. Black people don't know how to build anything now because they used to build places for white people, but they cut them off with things called unions, took them out, took the carpentry all out of the schools and all like that. So how many black people do you know that know how to fix anything now? It used to be thousands and millions of black people that know how to build a house from scratch out of old pieces of lumber.
Wow.
A lot of people don't remember that. Most people are not that old to have seen it done. Coming along, I'm old enough to remember when many black people used to get together on a Saturday afternoon. That was the only time they had off, or sometimes, or on a Sunday sometimes after church. They would get together, six or eight of them, and go down and build what they call a shotgun house. It wasn't much, but it was a roof over your head, a good solid roof. I've been in some of those houses, raised up in some, all right? They were excellent, solid houses. They could stand a lot of storm and rain. They weren't much, just maybe three rooms. But I've been in some of them, and there were many, 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 many of them. But along came the white supremacists and say, these Negroes know how to build stuff. We're going to fix that so the next generation won't know how to do anything except stand in front of a place that is built and big, because they won't know anything about carpentry or masonry or how to make anything with their hands.
Don't mess with gravity. Slave Entrepreneur Month, and it's also Black Towns History Month. So we have a niche within the Black History Month genre, which is February, but we concentrate on two history months that we concentrate on when in this month of February of 2022. Slave Entrepreneur Month, where we take a look at people who were born slaves and became entrepreneurs, and some of them became wealthy entrepreneurs, and Black Towns History Month. There's a lot with all of that. All right, so today's podcast we're featuring, and we do one a day, Monday through Friday, is Lunsford Lane. So let's see. Let's get into Lunsford Lane. Okay. And I'm just going from Wikipedia. Lunsford Lane, born May 30th, 1803, transitioned June 27th, 1879, was an entrepreneur from North Carolina who bought freedom for himself and his family. You know, a lot of these slave movies that come out of Hollywood, I really don't watch them because they haven't done anything. They don't touch people like this. I mean, the closest you got was probably Django. But there's a lot of really positive and inspiring stories of some very resilient people. Lunsford Lane is one of them. Anyway, so he bought his freedom, which dispels a myth that black folks work for free. Reparations people, what's your answer to that? And anyway, he became a vocal opponent of slavery and wrote a slave narrative autobiography. His life and narrative shows the plight of slavery, even for the relatively privileged slaves. All right, now, before I go in further on him, we're going to cover this month and throughout the year. The slave narrative is a type of literary genre involving the written autobiographical accounts of enslaved Africans, particularly in the Americas. Over 6,000 such narratives are estimated to exist. That's a lot of stories. Okay. About 150 narratives were published as separate books or pamphlets. In the United States during the Great Depression, 1930s, more than 2,300 additional oral histories on the life during slavery were collected by writers, sponsored and published by the Works Progress Administration, a New Deal program. Most of the 26 audio recorded interviews were held by the Library of Congress. Some of the earliest memoirs of captivity known in the English-speaking world were written by white Europeans and later Americans captured and sometimes enslaved in North Africa by local Muslims and Barbary pirates. They were part of a broad category of captivity narratives. Man, there's so much to this. What do they say about captivity narratives? Captivity narratives were usually stories of people captured by enemies whom they considered uncivilized or whose beliefs and customs they opposed. The best-known captivity narratives in North America are those concerning Europeans and Americans taken captives by the indigenous people of North America. These narratives have been an enduring place have had an enduring place in literature, history, and study of Native peoples. Okay, well, this goes on to, and there's quite a bit here. But today, let's get back on Lunsford Lane. And there's a picture, if you're on Blog Talk Radio, there's a picture of it. Anyway, a picture of him. All right, let's see. Lunsford Lane was born near Raleigh, North Carolina. His parents, Edward and Clarissa Lane, were enslaved house servants, commonly called houseslaves, in the family of Sherwood Haywood in Raleigh, North Carolina. The surname Lane came from their original owners. The only child, Lunsford Lane, also became a servant of the family. This gave him far more opportunities than were available to enslaved field workers, often called field slaves, but he dreamt of freedom. He earned his first money by selling a basket of peaches his father had given him. This was the start of a varied entrepreneurial career. This is what I love about the free enterprise system and capitalism in this country. Because even then, even if you were a slave, you were free to make money. Lane sold marbles and saved money he was given by guests who visited the homes. You won't see that in the TV show Roots. All right. From his father, he had learned how to prepare smoking tobacco. And I think that profession back then was called tobaccoist. Because many, many slaves who became entrepreneurs, Tejans, and being a tobaccoist was one of the skill sets that Lunsford Lane had. Lane improved on it and made tobacco with an especially sweet and pleasant taste. I guess he was the originator of the, I'm not a smoker or nothing like that, but my stepfather, he would smoke a pipe, cherry blend and all these different type of blends. Anyway, he made it by night when he was free from the housework. He also made a pipe with reeds and a hot wire and clay, which he sold in the early part of the night and produced in the latter. So basically, this dude was into manufacturing in his own way. Many of the local legislators became his customers, and he was able to expand his business and have others sell the products on commission. So this dude had a sales force. He made his own product. He had a de facto factory in his bedroom or slave quarters or whatever. Okay. And he had a sales force himself. Now, one of the reasons why this is Slave Entrepreneur Month is because we can take a lot of ideas here in 2022 that these slave entrepreneurs use and apply them to what we're doing today. We don't have to go to Harvard. Yeah, we don't have to go to the government or nothing like that. Take some of these ideas and just apply them to what you do. Lunsford Lane had no internet connection. He had no smartphone. He had no college degree. But yet, he was making money. Okay, let's see. He became known as a tobacco connoisseur, which was his artisan trade or skill level. While doing this work as a house slave in the daytime, he also sold firewood, worked as a handyman, and was a messenger in the Governor Edward B. Daley's office. Let's see. Sherwood Haywood died, and his widow had to rent out Lane. he was also passive income. This was lucky for him since he was able to rent himself out for $100 to $120 a year, when $100 and $120 a year was real money. Eventually, he had saved up enough money to purchase his own freedom for $1,000. Any of you listening out there, go to your search engine, type into the search engine inflation calculator, and see what that'll be. That $1,000 back then would be worth today. He married Martha Curtis in May 1828. They had seven children. He would spend another 18 years purchasing his family. He was still legally a slave in North Carolina, since the law required a slave to have done meritorious service to become free man in that state. Lane instead traveled with a friend to New York, and in 1835, where he was granted freedom. 5 years later, in 1840, he was notified that since he got his freedom in New York, he violated state law forbidding free blacks in other states from staying in North Carolina for more than 20 days. He petitioned for an exception, but was forced to leave the next year. Forbidden from leaving his home state, he moved to New York and Boston in the North. There he earned money to free his family by speaking as an abolitionist in meetings. This dude was an entrepreneur. Go online and read more about Lunsford Lane. We've got some more time here. I might get off another one before the end of the program. Matter of fact, I will. I'm going to change the program title. It's still Slave Entrepreneur. We're going to feature another one. Now, we've just done Lunsford Lane, but we're going to do another one. We're going to feature two today because there's so many of them. We can do one for every day of the year, and there'll still be many more we haven't covered. Once again, this is Slave Entrepreneur Month and Black Towns History Month here on It's My House. Because my whole thing is this. If Lunsford Lane can make it and make it wealthy, then we have absolutely no excuses on getting wealthy in this country. All right. Once again, this is Slave Entrepreneur Month and Black Towns History Month. We're going to take a, I'll tell you what, here's what we're going to do. We're going to come back with another person that was born into slavery and did well for themselves. And they weren't talking about reparations. They didn't get any help from the government. They didn't have any cell phones or the technology that we have today, or anything like that. So what we're going to do, we're going to take this quick little musical interlude as soon as my, Okay. All right, I'm waiting for my board to boot back up. And we're going to update our title for today. We started off with Slave Entrepreneur Lunsford Lane. We're going to change that we're going to add another person on. So, oh, man. Okay, we're going to take this musical interlude and come right back with another feature for the day. We typically do one a day, but we can do one a day for every day of the year. Actually, we can probably do it for the next 4 or 5 years. Actually, we can probably do it for a whole decade. There were a slew of people who were born slaves here in what we now call the United States, started businesses and prospered, and many of them bought their freedom. We'll be back with the next one in a few minutes.
Go. We got one out of two of them motherfuckers, you know. You mean you motherfuckers come strolling in here all walking tall and shit?
Yo, B.I., man, I'm saying, man, we was blazing on them dudes, man, you know what I'm saying? Just got in the heat, man. We was blazing, though. It was late.
All right, relax, man. I already heard. Go sit down. I'm not tweaking behind none of this. That's one less motherfucker that's breathing than was yesterday. You know what I'm saying? So we all good. But I'm surprised at you, though, man. Shit didn't get by you back when.
Well, my man's fault, man. I unloaded on the younger too soon, man. Gave him enough room to buck and run, man. I fucked that shit up myself, you know.
Hold on. It's on me. I had that kid in my sights. Close enough to take off his Kango and half his dome with it. Couldn't squeeze the trigger. Couldn't do it, man.
Why not?
Wasn't in me, I guess. You know, whatever it is in you that lets you flow like you flow and do that thing, it ain't in me no more.
All right. So you done soldiering, but you ain't done. Could use you for what you got in your head. We're going to put you on a corner. You could be inside.
Oh, man. I ain't making myself clear. The game ain't in me no more. None of it.
But you ain't done shit else. You know what I'm saying? So what you going to do?
I don't know. But it can't be this.
All right, then. We straight.
Man in his time, you know?
Yeah. He a man today. He a man.
What's it like to live where you work? For most of us, that's unthinkable. But imagine living and working at one of the biggest factories in the world. Workplace the size of Monaco. For these 17,000 employees, it's reality. They come from all over China, seeking a brighter future at this factory called Yupa. Workers craft coffee makers, irons, and electric grills in staggering quantities every single day. But Yupa is more than a steady paycheck. It's home. People get married here. They send their kids to school here, but the work never stops. Yupa's managers are on a mission to produce new products for every corner of the globe that could forever change the way we think of made in China. Step behind the closed doors of modern China into a factory the size of a city. Welcome to the place that calls itself Factory of the World. By the time you finish watching this program, Yupa's 17,000 Chinese workers will produce nearly 20,000 electrical appliances. Every day they churn out 60,000 irons. Every month, Yupa makes 36,000 coffee makers. That's two new machines for every Starbucks on the planet. And every year, these laborers produce a staggering 18 million electric grills. Stacked side by side, they'd span the Atlantic from New York to London. Chances are you own something built right here. Factories like these.
I had to open up my mic. Here on It's My House, all right, for nationwide in the United States, February is known as Black History Month. And we do something a little bit different here on It's My House. It's My House, to us, we have two subgenres within that. We are observing what I call, okay, we've coined this, Slave Entrepreneur Month, where every day that we're on, you know, we're on Monday through Friday, we feature at least one slave entrepreneur. In other words, somebody that was born a slave here in the United States and became a slave, and in many cases became a wealthy slave through entrepreneurship here in the United States, basically displacing some of the myths that have been out here and people believe. That's, once again, that's why I really don't watch slave movies that come out of Hollywood, because other than maybe Django, none of them have featured slave entrepreneurs, to my knowledge. All right. But that's all right. Maybe that's something that we need to do. We did all last week. There's only one person that we went through that last week that wasn't born a slave, but I think, well, let's see, we did four out of the five, 80% of the people that we featured last week, all of them were black, but 80% of the people that we featured last week were born slaves and became entrepreneurs. Some became wealthy. Well, they came wealthy in their own right. Okay. Even by white folks' standard, you have people that achieved, you have people that were born slaves that have achieved what some people haven't even done in 2022. So today we started off by featuring slave entrepreneur Lunsford Lane, all right, who, like many other slaves, he had a business. It was legal. Now, this is during slavery now. Slaves were allowed to participate in the free enterprise capitalist system during slave times. They didn't ask for no reparations. They didn't get no government help. Lunsford Lane was one of them. So we started the program with him. I've added on another one who I'm going to read here right now. And her name is Bethany Vinnie. I don't have a picture of her, you know, because I just ran across her. But Bethany Vinnie, and that's spelled V-E-N-E-Y, born 1812, she was born even between 1812 and 1815, and her sunset was November 16, 1915. She was born a slave on a farm near Luray, Virginia, as Bethany Johnson, whose autobiography, Aunt Betty's Story, The Narrative of Bethany, a Slave Woman, was published in 1889. Now, a lot of these people, some of these slaves or former slaves, they were self-published. They didn't wait to get a book deal. A lot of them self-published their own works. In any event, she was married twice, first to an enslaved man, Gerald Ficklin, whom she had a daughter, Charlotte. He was sold away from her, and she later married Frank Vinnie, a free black man. All right. She was sold on an auction block to her employer, George J. Adams. He bought her to Providence, Rhode Island, followed by Worcester, I can't pronounce that, Massachusetts. After the Civil War, Vinay made 4 trips to Virginia to move her daughter and family and 16 additional family members to New England. All right. Let's see. Now, you can go online and read about Bethany Vinney. That's Bethany Vinney, V-E-N-E-Y. How did she make her money? She was a slave entrepreneur, or started off slave who became an entrepreneur. One of the jobs that she did was she would cook food. She earned money by cooking food. You can see she was a de facto chef. And she was a washerwoman. She was a washing woman. She had a laundry business. She did people's laundry. And what's interesting about a lot of these entrepreneurial roles that slaves took on, not all of them, but many of them, while they were still legally slaves, and that's how they were able to earn money to buy out their situation with their, what we would call today, a master. And get free. And really, you know what? The same thing, I mean, happens here in 2022. If you got a 30-year mortgage on your house, you're basically a debt slave. So, you got to go to work Monday through Friday with that 40-hour week job to earn the money to pay that back. Now, some people pay it off early because just like this, that's why we do Slave Entrepreneur Month, because in my opinion, many of these slave entrepreneurs were more financially literate than a lot of your people graduating from Harvard, Yale, or Stanford today with an MBA in finance, business and finance. Number one, they're not getting into debt. I mean, back then, look at some of the gems that, you know, these people left behind. For the most part, they didn't get into debt. Number two, or if they did, they had a way to pay it off. Now, once again, Lunsford Lane, who we feature first, he started off entrepreneurial. He sold peaches. That's how he got started on an entrepreneurial level. He was also a handyman. Now, let me get some distinctions down that are very important when it comes to slave entrepreneurs, what they did and what you can model today and get wealthy. A lot of these jobs are not sexy. Selling peaches is not a sexy job. Bethany Vinay, who we're talking about right now, cooking food for other people isn't really sexy unless you call yourself a celebrity chef or a personal chef. That might sound a little bit sexy. But, you know, that's what she did. She also did people's laundry. The common denominator, now this is one of the nuggets I want you guys to take back, that they did then and what you can do now. The common denominator, you know what? No, well, If you guys know what the common denominator is, call us right now, 619-768-2945. There's a common denominator there. In any event, you probably need to think about it. There's a common denominator, particularly the ones who got wealthy, the slave entrepreneurs who got wealthy. There's a common denominator there that take what they did then and do it today, you can get wealthy. In any event, let's go back to Factory City. If you got any input, 619-768-2945.
What's it like to live where you work? For most of us, that's unthinkable. But imagine living and working at one of the biggest factories in the world. A workplace the size of Monaco. For these 17,000 employees, it's reality. They come from all over China, seeking a brighter future at this factory called Yupa. Workers craft coffee makers, irons, and electric grills in staggering quantities every single day. But Yupa is more than a steady paycheck. It's home. People get married here. They send their kids to school here. But the work never stops. Yupa's managers are on a mission to produce new products for every corner of the globe that could forever change the way we think of made in China. Step behind the closed doors of modern China into a factory the size of a city. Welcome to the place that calls itself Factory of the World. By the time you finish watching this program, Yupa's 17,000 Chinese workers will produce nearly 20,000 electrical appliances. Every day they churn out 60,000 irons. Every month, Yupa makes 36,000 coffee makers. That's two new machines for every Starbucks on the planet. And every year, these laborers produce a staggering 18 million electric grills. Stacked side by side, they'd span the Atlantic from New York to London. Chances are you own something built right here. Factories like these don't exist in North America or Europe, but they're not uncommon in China, where labor is cheap. Yupa runs on human sweat alone. No need for robots. To ensure non-stop production, workers need a steady stream of parts. Someone has to make sure those parts get to the right place in time. This is Ming Long Pa. He started work at Yupa in 1994. I'm in charge of production control. Production control is the brain of the factory. Its main function is to coordinate each department. If any of Yupa's factories run out of parts, Mr. He's job is on the line. The production line cannot wait. We have to guarantee that our production is smooth. Running out of materials would affect our efficiency, affect our productivity, and affect our revenue. So I have to fix this in the shortest time possible. Today, a problem at the iron factory needs smoothing out. Workers on the iron line are low on a crucial part. To keep up production, they need 2,000 units, and they need them now.
Just now I found out the main problems here at the iron department. One major problem is the case for model 603. They need 2,000 right now.
Traditional plants use outside suppliers for their components, not Yupa. To slash costs and stay competitive, Yupa builds its own parts on site. So Mr. Hu's supplier is only a bike ride away. But even the supplier is dangerously low on stock. Mr. He has found barely enough parts to last the day. When he gets another urgent call, now the grill factory is low on a crucial component. Grills are the company's most profitable products. Yupa started producing one line of grills in 1994. Now, 60 assembly lines churn out 800 different models. Workers make one grill every 12 seconds. That's 50,000 grills per day, or 1.5 million per month. Enough grills for every person in Dallas. Grills bring in $350 million a year, but Yupa wants more. Little wonder Lu Jinye acts like a general leading his troops to war. By next year, managers expect workers to crank out $500 million worth of grills. Yupa's profits have to rise to outmuscle the competition. Mr. Ye supervises 850 workers on 30 lines.
We have to coordinate all these workers and pull all their thoughts into one. It takes teamwork to accomplish our goals, to get the results we want.
Mr. Ye is obsessed with quality control. His aim? Boost output without compromising quality. In a factory this big, with a production run so massive, even the hyper-efficient Mr. Ye hits a roadblock.
This holder piece holds the grill plate. What we're seeing now is the assembly of this piece. The problem is the size. It's the wrong size.
They've run out of part number 2627. It attaches the core heating element to the frame. Without this simple component, assembly lines will shut down. Unless Mr. Ha finds a fresh supply. And soon.
If we don't get them the parts, 6 production lines will have to stop.
When every part is on hand, grills assemble like a simple puzzle. Wires are linked to the heating element, and the element is fixed to the plate.
When it's not locked down properly, it will fall off. If it falls off, it will burn the hands of our customers and consumers. This job is very important.
Then it's time to connect the power cord.
The brown wire is live and the green wire is neutral. The one with the writing on it matches the brown wire. Connect them and that makes the wire live.
Each grill is inspected for flaws in construction or appearance. Finally, every grill is tested to make sure everything is in working order. On a typical day, Mr. Ye's team must make 700 of Yupa's 50,000 grills. Missing parts cause delays, cost Yupa a fortune, and force workers into overtime to meet their quota. Finding the missing parts falls to Mr. Ha, and the pressure is on.
Mr. He finally arrives, and he has good news.
小叶，老六。没吧？这边已经那个模具刚刚才修好。抱歉。数量多少？这边有2000个。
He's found 2,000 parts to keep the lines moving, and 50,000 more are on the way. Mr. He's day has ended on a high note. He heads home to a company-subsidized apartment only minutes away. His wife, Hong Zhang-Yu, also works for the plant. Together, they lead a life of relative luxury. Family life in China is a communal affair. His parents and his in-laws live here, thanks to Yupa. It's one more reason workers are fiercely loyal to their company.
Our products all have the Made in China tag. I hope our products can bring to consumers a sense of joy, a sense of it's worth it. This is my biggest wish.
Fulfilling that wish will come at a cost.
When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Yupa's next generation of workers must leave their families behind and devote their lives to the company. It's a place tourists never see. The new face of modern China. Competitive, hungry for profits, and ready to take on the world. Located near the city of Xiaomeng, the Yupa complex sprawls for 1.8 square kilometers, almost the size of Monaco.
We have about over 20 buildings here. You know, the largest building, you know, equal like 4 football fields. You can have 60 to 70 assembly lines. Each assembly line can have 25 to 35 workers in the line.
25 years ago, there were no factories here, only farms. In the 1980s, the Chinese government decided capitalism wasn't so bad after all. The communist regime established so-called special economic zones, designated places for free markets and foreign investments. Yupa, a Taiwanese company, moved here in 1988. In a few short years, it became the largest manufacturer of irons, electric grills, and espresso makers in the world. Yupa is a city unto itself, with restaurants and convenience stores, soccer fields and basketball courts, and living quarters for everyone from students to families. Success made it big, and size keeps it successful. Mass production runs push down costs. Almost all parts are made on-site, keeping supply costs low and parts within easy reach.
Because we are in this location pretty much isolated, we don't have satellite suppliers around us to build, you know, parts for us. So we had to do it in-house, and we had to do it in a large scale.
Yupa's main advantage is a cheap and endless labor force, ready to work for a fraction of a Western wage. 16-year-old Mao Fen Guo left her family and came here in 2008. But Guo isn't just looking for work. She's here to escape poverty and make her mother proud. In China, many parents prefer sons to daughters.
My mother has only 2 daughters. She's always upset about that. And in order to not let her down, I must work harder and harder.
Guo is a worker in training. With about 1,000 other students, she attends Yupa's on-site trade school. To get here, she had to pass entry exams and pay Yupa tuition. Now she's enrolled in 3 years of study and hands-on training at the factory. If she does well, Guo hopes for a job at DuPont.
At the very beginning, I thought it was very hard. But now that I've gone through all this, it's easier. There's a lot to learn, but I'm still full of confidence.
Today, she and her classmates are learning everything they ever wanted to know and more about irons. To get a job, Guo must learn the ins and outs of every product line.
We're changing constantly. Last time, we were making grills. Then we changed to coffee makers, and now electric irons.
Workers on 27 production lines pump out an iron every 15 seconds, and as many as 60,000 irons a day. Production includes at least 10 separate brands for dozens of companies. With over 30 steps to assembly, iron making is intricate work. And there's no room for error. Assembly starts with a water spray unit, made up of springs, rubber, and washers. With training and practice, it snaps into the spout in seconds.
If it's not closed tight, it will leak or blow. Then it won't work properly.
Now the sprayer and spout are joined to the handle. The two parts of the water reservoir are placed in a heating machine. That melts the space between them and makes the reservoir watertight.
Welding is an important part of production. However, it will be easy as long as we follow our operational guidelines.
Next, the thermostat is attached to the base.
You need to make sure you're using the correct format before you insert the base. Using a wrong base can lead to fire. Wiring is also important. Where there is a wiring mistake, there's hidden trouble.
A plastic buffer is placed between the heating element and the handle to keep the handle and the user's hand from getting too hot. After that, the plug is welded to the back of the iron.
We're connecting the wire for the power supply. I can do about 4 to 5 pieces every minute and 300 pieces an hour.
Once the spray and steam buttons are attached, it's testing time. First, the steam and squirting functions. Second, the iron's electrical system. Faulty units are either repaired or removed. Finally, irons that pass inspection are packed up and shipped away. The team won't cut corners or settle for second best. Today, Guo and her classmates will put classroom theory into practice and work the iron mine. For a teenager from a small town, living and working in a giant factory can be overwhelming.
My life is not as hard as it was before. I'm getting used to this place now.
Work on the iron line goes better than expected. For Guo, juggling work and school isn't that difficult. The hard part is leaving family and living far from home.
I guess it's learning how to be independent. When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Like China, Guo is adapting to a new world of high technology and tough international competition. And like China itself, she's determined to succeed.
I don't see myself working on the production line forever, doing the same job. Maybe I'm a bit arrogant or too confident about myself, but I want a better future.
For some people, a better future keeps them married to their job. Workers at Yupa are married to the company. Based in southeast China, Yupa is one of the biggest factories on the planet. Today and every day, its 17,000 workers are getting the world ready for breakfast. In the next 24 hours, it will produce 1,200 conventional coffee makers. Over the next 30 days, these assembly lines will deliver 210,000 cappuccino espresso machines. In the space of 1 year, nearly 2.5 million coffee makers will pour out of Yupap and into the kitchens of the world. At the center of all this is Young Lee.
We already have 200 or 300 styles, and we develop and add over 40 new styles every year.
Lee's mandate is crucial and broad. Tackle any problem that could slow down non-stop production.
We have to make every effort to find these problems and to solve them. We have to make sure that every process is working perfectly. Manufacturing shouldn't be delayed because of these problems.
Today, he's got a brand new kind of problem. One of Yupa's big clients has designed a new coffee maker. It's up to Lee to build a working prototype to entice the client into going ahead with mass production. Hundreds of Yupa jobs and millions of dollars in potential business are now in Lee's hands.
Making prototypes is a large portion of my job and is vitally important to the development of the company.
Lee starts by assembling the heating system for the water and steam. Then he carefully places it into the main body. Just when Lee's ready to assemble it all, there are parts missing. The supplier is just a walk away, a long walk, but Lee doesn't mind the distance. Someone special is waiting for him at the supply depot. The person helping him today is his girlfriend. These perks make Yupa more than a place of work. With a workforce of 17,000, many of them married with kids, this factory city turns office space into personal space.
Sometimes we work together. For example, if we need the help from the technician to solve production problems, then we meet each other afterwards.
Li Yang Li works in the parts supply department. She first came to Yupa in 2004.
We fell in love at first sight. I always think it must be God who makes her work here and wait for me. Even now, I still think the same.
Yupa management encourages these intimate connections. They believe couples that work together are more loyal to the company.
By working in the same company, we can go to work together and take care of each other. We can see each other more often. What's more, we can be with each other when we have a problem.
With the missing parts in hand, Lee is ready for wiring. Making it all fit into the chamber isn't easy.
I will have to organize all the electrical wires properly to make sure the coffee maker operates safely.
But the real test will come after shipping. If the client approves of Lee's model, Yupa could get a massive order. If it doesn't, hundreds of jobs are on the line.
If I make the prototype in a sloppy way, our customers will lose confidence in the quality of our products. It will be a great loss to our company.
Weeks later, Lee's model is approved for mass production. And right away, he sets out to create a brand new production line. It takes a week to prepare the assembly line and train the workers to make the new coffee machine.
Making a coffee maker is not an easy job at all. It requires professional knowledge and a profound understanding of coffee culture.
When the prep is done, Factory City springs into action and works with astonishing speed. Lee's prototype took half a day to make. Now line workers churn out 700 machines a day. Lee's shift is done, and when work ends at Factory City, romance begins.
When we're done work, we normally go shopping together or take a walk. It gives us a sense of happiness.
The couple plan to get married at a mass wedding, paid for and organized by the company. All at once, dozens of Yupa workers will tie the knot, while thousands of co-workers look on.
If we take part in the group wedding, with the best wishes of all of our co-workers here, we know we will be getting married in the factory of the world, one dream, and that would be unforgettable.
A mass wedding is the couple's way of showing their love for each other and their passion for Yupa. Chef Xing Ming Li has a passion of his own, feeding the 17,000 workers that power the factory of the world. At Factory City, the day has barely begun. But Chef Xing Ming Li already faces his first daily deadline. Lee runs one of five independent restaurants at Yupa. Competition between them is intense. Profits are razor thin, and Lee needs thousands of customers every day just to survive. In his eyes, he's not just serving meals, he's fueling the workers that power the factory of the world.
If they don't eat well, or eat enough, they won't have enough energy. Then they won't perform well at Yupa.
It all starts with fresh ingredients. Beef, pork, bok choy, onions, carrots, and winter melon.
We have all fresh seasonal vegetables here. Whatever you can find from the food market, you can find here.
Everything is washed, sliced, and diced. Yupa churns out millions of kitchen appliances a year. But there are no food processors in Lee's kitchen. Nothing is automated. Everything is done by hand. By 9 a.m., Lee's staff is already racing against the clock.
We'll have to finish everything before 11 o'clock because Yupa staff restaurants all open at 11:30. We have to be there in advance.
In 2 hours, 3,000 workers will stop by for lunch. Lee expects just as many for dinner. This means his staff of 50 must serve 6,000 meals by sunset. That's 125 kilograms of oil, 50 kilograms of beef, and 300 kilograms of pork. That's more than 1 million tons of food every year. His chefs turn stock ingredients into hundreds of delicious dishes.
We can make different cuisines. Our chefs are all the best of their hometown.
They cook up dishes from Fujian, Sichuan, and Henan regions, and they'll soon add halal fare for Muslim clients.
I believe everything that we cook should taste like what your mom cooks for you at home.
Lee's obsession with food comes from growing up hungry.
My family was very poor. Although my dad was working very hard to earn money, he still didn't have much food to eat.
Now food is never in short supply, and all of Lee's clients return to work with their bellies full. Lee's passion for food has made him a perfectionist. He hunts the market for produce that's perfectly ripe and reasonably priced. In his kitchens, Lee controls the cooks, and no dish goes out without his approval.
Too bland. Some salt and chicken stock will make it taste better.
The special today is spicy Sichuan pork.
Actually, anyone can cook. The key is our chefs make their own special seasonings that you can't get from the market.
Lee insists the pork must be extremely fresh. He expects perfect timing from every cook.
Timing is what the chefs are really good at, but they may not be willing to share that information.
But now it's almost 10 a.m., and Lee's kitchen is about to hit the boiling point. With the clock ticking, the team of chefs are stir-frying and stewing to feed an army.
It might be a bit of an exaggeration to say that it's a battlefield, but it's true that we're really busy. We have to finish everything within 1 hour. Then we will deliver them to our restaurants. We don't have time to do other things.
By 11 a.m., they pull it off. Dozens of different dishes for 3,000 people and right on time. Drivers rush the dishes to the restaurant nearby. Competition between the five independent restaurants at Yupa keeps quality and choice high and prices low. Workers pay about 50 cents per meal, thanks to a company subsidy. To turn a profit, thousands of customers must pass through Lee's door each day. But it's not profits that keep Lee up at night. More than anything, he wants people to enjoy his food.
I've experienced a lot of sleepless nights. I often blame myself for the mistakes that occurred in the daytime. I should have done better.
So far, his customers look happy. After lunch, while workers crank out appliances, Lee will be planning dinner, determined to satisfy his next 3,000 customers.
I hope that Yupa and everyone else will trust me and become my friends. I'll be content if they all come to dine in my restaurant.
If feeding workers at the factory of the world is tough, try being the guy who must make everyone get along. In this factory city, 17,000 people live and work inside 1.8 square kilometers. Rush hour is a human traffic jam. Just getting to work on time is a job well done. Inside these walls, office politics and conflicts play out on a massive scale. The man managing all this human friction could have Yupa's toughest job of all. Now in his second year on the job, Ya Xin Fu is the manager of Yupa's service department. His job, address anything that affects the day-to-day life of Yupa's 17,000 workers.
I have to find a balance between the costs of the company and the needs of the employees. Too little and the employees will be dissatisfied. Too much and the company won't be happy, so it's a big challenge.
Keeping Yupa's army of laborers in line is no small task. At this regular weekly meeting, Fu is boosting company morale.
Leading them is like raising children. We have to raise them with love.
Yupa's workers come from every corner of China. Most are in their 20s and 30s. They work on average 40 hours a week and make between 90 and 320 U.S. dollars a month. While wages are even higher in big cities like Shanghai, many Yupa workers make double what they did back home if they had any work there at all. As with any mass organization, thousands of employees create endless demands. It's Mr. Fu's job to address all of them. He does everything he can to keep everyone motivated and committed to staying at the factory of the world. Fu visits staff living quarters as part of his regular rounds.
We're now going to the workers' dormitory. I routinely go there to check if anything can be improved. If there is, I will talk to the superintendent.
Fu is part landlord and part tenant's rights advocate. Today, he's ensuring Yupa rooms are ready for a group of new workers. Average rent is only $6 per month, but the type of accommodation depends on a worker's rank and the amount of money they are willing to part with. Fu is paying a visit to Mao Fen Guo, who has a noise complaint. Fu believes that to build quality products, Yupa's workers must be well rested and well fed.
The challenge is that there are 17,000 employees and they come from all over China. Everyone has different tastes. I have to take care of everybody.
Yupa's restaurants are extremely competitive, and some have been known to skimp on meat portions to keep costs low. Yupa has strict rules about when and where vendors can sell their food. Fu keeps them in line.
Now we are going to check on the other restaurants. We have designated areas for them. If they break the rules, I will kick them out.
These vendors aren't trespassing. They work for the factory's restaurants. But they are breaking the rules by selling food too close to rival restaurants. Everyone must have a permit. A veteran on these streets, Fu recognizes this woman. He busted her once before. Today, Fu lets everyone off with a warning. Next time, he may ban them from selling food at Yupa.
I talk to them, but they will break the rules again, so I have to check on them every day.
China's web of cultures complicates Fu's job.
Everyone comes from different families and different provinces, so their customs of eating and living are totally different, so I have to adapt to them.
But one thing unites all of Yupa's workers, the world's most popular sport. On the field, tension and stress vanish.
Because employees are undergoing a lot of pressure at work, we have to give them an outlet and let them exercise. But most important is the team building.
Don't care for soccer? Yupa offers other ways for workers to get their exercise.
For entertainment, we have ball game competitions like basketball, table tennis, and other games.
these sorts of competitions.
It's all part of Foo's mission at one of the world's biggest factories, a place with no boundaries between work and life. For Foo, it's a never-ending battle to keep the peace and to keep the company together.
It really is a miracle, a company this big, with all the employees together, holding hands and moving forward. This is not easy.
And while there may be harmony inside Yuba's walls, outside, competition is cutthroat. In a global market, innovation is key. Yuba's employees must endure tough changes to survive. In the global marketplace, there's no room for second best. To survive, companies need a competitive edge. Like most China-based companies, Yuba has relied on low labor costs, making products designed by others. But it wants to move up the production food chain. Yuba's leaders want to design products of their own. They have little choice. To thrive and survive, Yuba must develop a new generation of products. The factory's very existence depends on it. Thousands of jobs hang in the balance.
No work means not being able to live. This is a fundamental requirement. It's how humans survive. You have to earn money to make a living, and to earn money, you have to work.
Ji Rong Pan knows how high the stakes are. He is Yuba's Vice President of Product Innovation.
I think innovation is the competitive edge of our company. Because our company is in the field of home appliances and the whole home appliance industry is a lifestyle industry.
Mr. Pan sent his staff overseas to study the lifestyle products of the future.